This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, November 1st, 2005. On Friday, October 28th, a federal grand jury indicted Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, I. Lewis Scooter Libby. Libby is also Cheney's assistant for national security affairs and assistant to President Bush. He resigned shortly after the indictment. The indictment came after a two-year investigation into the leak of a CIA agent's identity, the CIA agent being covert operative Valerie Plame Wilson. It was the only indictment that resulted from the grand jury investigation. Libby was indicted on charges of perjury, obstruction of justice, and making false statements. It was a five-count indictment, and it charged that he gave misleading information to the grand jury, allegedly lying about information he discussed with three news reporters. It alleged that he committed perjury before the grand jury in March 2004, and that he also lied to FBI agents investigating the case. Libby faces possible penalties, if convicted, of 50 years and a $1.25 million fine. Count 1, obstruction of justice, is U.S. Penal Code 18, Section 1503. Counts 2 and 3, false statements, U.S. Code 18, Section 1001A2, and counts 4 and 5, perjury, same code, section 1623. It's instructive to look at the prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald's press conference that he gave on October 28th. The press conference, the full text of which is on the internet, and I found it at the Washington Post website. The indictment as well is on the internet and is also interesting to see. Our program today, The Hidden Agenda of the Libby Indictment. We'll go further into the basis for the indictment. But first, let's listen to a bit of Fitzgerald's comments. Mr. Libby, he said, gave the FBI a compelling story. What he told the FBI is that essentially he was at the end of a long chain of phone calls. He spoke to reporter Tim Russett, and during the conversation, Mr. Russett told him that, hey, do you know that all reporters know that Mr. Wilson, that's referring to Joseph Wilson, a former ambassador, that Mr. Wilson's wife works at the CIA? And he told the FBI that he learned that information as if it were new, and it struck him. So he took this information from Mr. Russett and later passed it on to other reporters, including Matthew Cooper of Time magazine and reporter Judith Miller of the New York Times. Fitzgerald continues, he told the FBI that when he passed the information on July 12, 2003, 2 days before Mr. Robert Novak's column, that he passed it on understanding that this was information he had gotten from a reporter and he didn't know if it was true. And he told the FBI that when he passed the information on to reporters, he made clear that he did not know if this were true. Later, Mr. Libby went on before the grand jury on two occasions in March 2004. He took an oath and he testified, and he essentially said the same thing. He said that, in fact, he had learned from the vice president, that's Vice President Dick Cheney, earlier in 2003, information about Wilson's wife, but he had forgotten it. And that when he learned the information from Mr. Russett during this phone call, he learned it as if it were new. Fitzgerald then goes on to say that Lewis Libby, Scooter Libby as he is known, said he was just passing gossip from one reporter to another at the long end of a chain of phone calls. It would be a compelling story, Fitzgerald remarked, that would lead the FBI to go away if only it were true. It is not true, according to the indictment. In fact, Mr. Libby discussed the information about Valerie Wilson at least half a dozen times before this conversation with Mr. Russett ever took place. Not to mention that when he spoke to Mr. Russett and he never discussed Valerie Wilson or Wilson's wife. And this is a small excerpt of this very long press conference of Patrick Fitzgerald. Patrick Fitzgerald, who has been called the Elliot Ness, referring to the days of Al Capone and the FBI investigator Elliot Ness, who was so dogged in his pursuit of Al Capone. Ralph.
Well, Maya, we have to first begin by looking at how the persona of Patrick Fitzgerald has been sheep-dipped and presented to the American people and indeed to the public worldwide. Here's the San Francisco Chronicle on the 30th of October, quoting from a long piece by Mark Sandalo, the Washington bureau chief of the Chronicle, CIA leak probe analysis humbling the D.C. hierarchy. The outsider, Chicago prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, stood up to politicians and the press in his quest for justice. In an incestuous town renowned for grinding up outsiders, few will forget the boyish-looking prosecutor from Chicago, staring down two of the city's most venerable institutions. Circumstances, evidence, and lawyers will determine what role the prosecutor of Louis Scooter Libby will play in history. The damage has already cost the vice president his chief of staff and humbled the nation's most esteemed newspaper. Patrick Fitzgerald, the 44-year-old federal prosecutor, stood before a bank of cameras to announce the conclusion of his 22-month investigation, and he made it plain that no institution, not the White House, not the New York Times, not any of the revered establishments that in fact or fancy run this town, will stand in the way of his dogged pursuit of justice. Quote, "The truth is the engine of our judicial system, and if you compromise the truth, the whole process is lost," Patrick Fitzgerald stated. For a moment, it was as if all the partisan trickery, the spin, the half-truths, the exercises of privilege, and journalistic shortcuts so taken for granted in Washington had been suspended. Fitzgerald took what appeared to be another inside-the-beltway tempest and has turned it into a very public illustration of how the law is bound by no political allegiance and how justice trumps even the most well-established Washington games. Can you hear the orchestra in the background, brothers and sisters? He is this generation's Elliot Ness, as Maya cited, referring to the famed agent who went after Al Capone's 1920s Chicago mob. He goes into this jaded, immoral town, and he tries to be morally accountable.
As William Branigan, Carol Loenig, and Christopher Lee, Washington Post staff writers, wrote on Friday, October 28th, in Cheney Advisors Indicted in the CIA Leak Probe, they refer to the investigation itself. The CIA had asked the Justice Department to investigate the leak. This is the leak that resulted with the July 14th publication by Robert Dean Novak, a syndicated columnist, exposing in an article about Wilson's African mission, looking into the truth or the fiction of the Niger yellow cake, that is the uranium product that was supposedly bought by the Iraqis in order to make nuclear bombs. The investigation by Wilson, according to Novak's article, suggested that the trip was instigated by Wilson's wife and did not have high-level backing. Novak named Plain as, quote, an agency operative on weapons of mass destruction and said, quote, two senior administration officials, end quote, had told him that she had suggested sending her husband on the Niger trip. The CIA then asked the Justice Department to investigate the leak, and Fitzgerald, described by the Post, as Ralph had mentioned with the Chronicle, as a hard-charging U.S. attorney in Chicago, was appointed special counsel for the probe in late December 2003. His charge was to determine whether anyone involved in the leak violated federal law, including and most particularly the Intelligent Identities Protection Act of 1982, otherwise known as the Lew Wolf Act, because the act was put into force in order to suspend the important and the critical work of Lew Wolf of Covert Action Bulletin and of Philip Agee in exposing the heinous crimes of CIA agents around the world. The act makes it a felony, punishable by up to 10 years in prison for a person with access to classified information to intentionally disclose the identity of a covert agent to anyone not authorized to receive classified information. Aside from the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982, high-level federal officials also sign an executive order, a statement saying that they will not disclose the identities or release any classified information, and I, Lewis Libby, had signed that. So here we have Fitzgerald, this hard-charging U.S. attorney in charge of this critical investigation.
I want to mention something here, since you were prescient enough to discuss the implications of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. Bear in mind that the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, otherwise known as the Lew Wolf Act of 1982, is intimately linked to the Classified Information Non-Disclosure Agreement, which is U.S. Code Title 18. The combination of these two acts constitutes a virtual National Secrets Act, such as you find in Great Britain. And it, in fact, exposes the people who are being examined here to between 30 and 50 years imprisonment. What are we really looking at with respect to this legislation? Because before we talk about who this so-called Elliot Ness is, Patrick Fitzgerald, we need to understand the deeply reactionary, proto-fascist character of the acts that are being celebrated by the putative left, from Counterpunch to The Nation to you name it, to Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky to others who are broadcasting on Pacifica, of the indictments that are being brought down by Patrick Fitzgerald. Bear in mind that the Intelligence Identities Protection Act was brought into play because Lew Wolf and Philip Agee began to expose the covert operations of the Central Intelligence Agency, which mean death squads, which mean fingering dissidents, which mean authorizing coup d'etat, which mean organizing assassinations, the very illegalities that would bring them into prison if they were brought to justice ever within a United States court, were sanctioned across the world. That means that you and I, when we go about exposing who killed Kennedy, when we want to show that the Central Intelligence Agency and Richard Helms had designated a series of covert operatives like Clay Shaw, like Lee Harvey Oswald, like Jack Ruby, like Guy Bannister, the whole range of these people, to commit treason at the top, that we would be committing a crime by exposing the acts of the Central Intelligence Agency's covert operations, the Special Forces, the Green Berets, the Phoenix programs, the assassination squads. This is a deeply reactionary piece of legislation that is designed to shut down free speech, to silence the critics of capitalism, to make it impossible to expose the criminal nature of the capitalist state. That's the real context here, and that's the real meaning of this current investigation, whatever its nominal target.
Ralph, over and over, reporters have asked Fitzgerald how come he didn't indict under the Intelligence Protection Act and also under the Espionage Act. And what Fitzgerald said is that if national defense information, which is involved because of Plame's affiliation with the CIA, whether or not she was covert, was classified, and if that was intentionally transmitted, that would violate the statute known as Section 793, which is the Espionage Act, and in fact, which he interprets as something like the Official Secrets Act in Great Britain. But what he is saying is that I, Lewis Libby, had obstructed the investigation by lying to the grand jury and to the FBI, and consequently, they couldn't determine his state of knowledge or his intent. In fact, they couldn't get to the facts. Now, he also made a point, and this is where he is in some of the references that are made to Elliot Ness and the trials of Al Capone, because Al Capone, as you will recall, was charged on tax evasion and not on the crimes for which the FBI was investigating him. And as in this case, with the grand jury investigation, I. Lewis Libby was charged with obstruction of justice and with perjury. And what Fitzgerald said, quote, "When you do a criminal case, if you find a violation, it doesn't really in the end matter what statute you use if you vindicate the interest." Now, it's important to listen to the last part of this, because this is what leads into the real biography and the real intentions of Patrick Fitzgerald. And that is, it doesn't matter in the end what statute you use. And in fact, it doesn't matter to Fitzgerald what he uses if you vindicate the interest. Vindicate the interest. Those are the key words here. Ralph, who is Patrick Fitzgerald?
Well, Maya, first of all, I want to mention that Patrick Fitzgerald has been emphatic in stating this is not about the war in Iraq. This is not about the politics of the Bush administration. This is simply a matter of pursuing the truth and of going after those who have violated certain acts. Now, this is an indictment not about the war. This is simply an indictment of whether some person lied or not, he says. One day I read I was a Republican hack. Another day I read I was a Democratic hack. And the only thing I did between these two nights was sleep. The White House must now defend itself against charges, the article in the Chronicle continues, leveled by a steel nerve prosecutor who seems to fit the mantle of Washington outsider far better than the politicians who frequently claim it. It is a rare day in the nation's capital, and developments of any sort are not ascribed to partisan politics. But here is a figure who comes into an investigation about the leaking of CIA agent Valerie Plame's identity. Fitzgerald showed no timidness as he bumped into the institutions revered. And he says, when he was not satisfied with the testimony of the president's top aide, he brought him back to the grand jury four times. When the top aide to the vice president provided information he deemed dishonest, he was charged with five felonies. And when reporters demanded that Fitzgerald engage in the age-old journalism game of speculating on the bigger underlying story, in this case the war in Iraq and the role of administration officials, he flat-out refused. I'm mindful of the necessity to discuss, as we are most certainly going to do, who Mr. Patrick Fitzgerald really is. But I want to first show the magnitude of the orchestration of support for this Fitzgerald undertaking. Here is Brian Cluffley in Counterpunch, and it's Valerie Plame and 30 Pieces of Silver. And it says, "The particularly contemptible instance of odious conduct by Bush freedom hiders took place in July 2003 when two officials in the administration used a warped and twisted germ to reveal the name of a CIA deep cover operative. Valerie Plame, Robert Novak, the sleazy creep who shrilled her name around the world, should have known it is a felony under the Intelligence Identities Protection Act to disclose the name of a U.S. agent. The sources that she had for years will be arrested, tortured, and killed. One thinks of the Bible's words in Matthew 16, verse 7, 'What will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you?' And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And if you think that anyone in the administration will go to jail for endangering the life of a loyal public servant by giving her name to a piece of mobile excreta, you have another think coming. Nobody outside the CIA should have known and should ever know the identity of one of its active or retired operatives," this man writes in Counterpunch. "Valerie Plame was willfully betrayed by someone who had access to ultra-secret CIA information." Here he quotes in Counterpunch St. Matthew, "Verily I say unto you that one of you shall betray me." He's comparing Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame to none other than Jesus Christ. "I know of two people who are under deep cover, and what sticks in my mind is the fact that they were dicing with death all day, every minute they were playing their parts. One false step and a deep cover agent is dead, and not just by shooting. The agonizing torment inflicted on them by their captors will make Abu Ghraib, Bahram, and Guantanamo Bay torture sessions look like a warm-up on an exercise bike. The IRA terrorists had the delightful habit of skinning people alive from the neck up. Their demented shrieking usually stopped just below the eyeballs. What are we dealing with here?
Ralph, I'll tell you who we're dealing with. Brian Cluffley, who is appears over and again in Counterpunch. Actually, if you go to the Counterpunch website, you'll find more recent articles by Brian Cluffley. The one from which Ralph is reading, Valerie Plame, 30 Pieces of Silver, appeared on Counterpunch February 24th, 2005, and is in their archive. Brian Cluffley is the Jane's Defense Magazine, the Islamic Affairs Analyst. That's what he is currently. His website, which is www.briancluffley.com, says he's a commentator on political and military affairs, specializing in South Asia and South Asia defense, a strategy analyst for Jane's Sentinel, covering Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. And he also writes for other Jane's publications. But let's look at his background. How does he come to this? He served in the British and Australian armies, joining in 1958. Then he served as an intelligence officer in Cyprus at the end of colonial rule. He was on an attachment to the Jordan Desert Police Force, which I imagine was in charge of the torture of prisoners. And he was a reconnaissance and survey officer on a nuclear missile regiment in Germany. And most importantly, that I found interesting in his bio, he was the officer commanding the Australian Psychological Operations Unit in Vietnam, the PSYOPS unit for the Australian Army. Now, this is the man who is decrying the exposure of Valerie Plame, presented in Counterpunch, an apologist for the CIA.
Well, in fact, this theme is articulated across the board. Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame appeared at a dramatic conference sponsored by The Nation, where Joseph Wilson broke down when he said that his wife had been exposed to such terrible things and her career placed in jeopardy. And as The Nation reporter describes it, there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Ralph, it was David Korn who first brought to light the fact that Novak was exposing and jeopardizing the lives of covert CIA operatives, and that was in The Nation magazine.
Well,
it really calls to question the function of The Nation magazine today.
Well, actually, The Nation magazine has on its editorial board now Max Holland, who writes on the CIA website and has spent his time attacking any critics of the Kennedy assassination as agents of the KGB.
Before we move on further, let's go back to Fitzgerald, because this really is key. Understanding who Fitzgerald is key to understanding the hidden agenda of the Libby indictment. Ralph, you did incredible research on Fitzgerald's bio, and I think we should bring that out right now.
Mr. Fitzgerald goes to Washington, Time magazine. Patrick Fitzgerald came to Washington not as a politician but as a prosecutor, the archetypical kind. And he is celebrated here with the following quotation. When a vice president's chief of staff is charged with perjury and obstruction of justice, it does show the world that this is a country that takes its law seriously and that all citizens are bound by the law. Unquote. And Time magazine states he used the word rules 13 times. Well, now, Maya, who indeed is Patrick Fitzgerald? Patrick Fitzgerald.
Well, Ralph, they start off telling you it's a rags to riches, because Patrick Fitzgerald is the son of a doorman on the Upper East Side, East 75th Street near Madison Avenue, the son of two Irish immigrants from County Cork. He was a scholarship student at a prestigious Catholic high school, and then he was at Amherst. and graduated from Harvard Law School. After a couple of years in private practice, he worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, and he began working there in 1988. He has had more than 17 years as a prosecutor, and it's the cases that he prosecuted that are the key to who this man really is.
Maya, in the 1990s, Patrick Fitzgerald, as Time magazine outlines it, put away mafia brothers, Islamic terrorists, and drug kingpins in New York. He pushed the envelope, invoking laws that other prosecutors wouldn't have touched. After the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, Patrick Fitzgerald, who was in charge of the prosecution, used the Civil War-era sedition statute to win the conviction of blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. May I point out, brothers and sisters, Patrick Fitzgerald, in close coordination with the Special Deputy State Attorney General in charge of this prosecution, Michael Chertoff, framed the blind Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. We have exposed, I wrote a piece in 1993, who bombed the World Trade Center. Imad Ali Salem, an FBI operative, an Egyptian intelligence official, went into the mosque of the blind Egyptian cleric on behalf of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He wore a wire, and he propositioned people who he invited to meetings to blow up the World Trade Center, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Statue of Liberty, the George Washington Bridge, and what is known as the Landmark Case. All of this prosecuted by who? Patrick Fitzgerald, using a Civil War-era sedition statute, and overlooking and ignoring and, in fact, concealing the fact that the agent provocateur who had organized the entire undertaking, Imad Ali Salem, did so on behalf of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, wore a wire to each meeting, 50 file boxes of the meetings in which the FBI's agent was proposing these acts. For 6 months prior to the event, these 50 file boxes of documents are the role of the FBI and of the Mossad in organizing this in the offices of the FBI in New York.
And, Ralph, also the role of Guzi Hadass.
And Guzi Hadass, the Mossad operative who organized the safe house. All of this under the careful watch of Patrick Fitzgerald. Now let's look a little more closely at this. Quote, Time magazine, he became the first prosecutor to use a new anti-terrorism law to get Abdulrahman imprisoned in isolation. Namely, he confined him to solitary confinement. Not only did he do that, Patrick Fitzgerald was the attorney who went after the lawyer for Sheikh Abdulrahman, namely, Lynn Stewart. The framing of Lynn Stewart was initiated by an appearance on the Jay Leno show by Attorney General John Ashcroft, who called for the imprisonment of the aider and abettor of terrorism, Lynn Stewart, the lawyer for the blind Egyptian cleric. Patrick Fitzgerald proceeded to prosecute Lynn Stewart, who now has been convicted and faces 30 years of imprisonment. And the prosecutor in that event was Patrick Fitzgerald.
He was also the first witness at the trial.
And he was tape recording all of the confidential lawyer-client meetings in the isolation cell. Meetings between Lynn Stewart and the blind Egyptian cleric were recorded, and they caught on tape a discussion in which Fitzgerald was described as follows. He's like a medieval crusader, said lawyer Lynn Stewart. In short, we have here the real nature of who this Patrick Fitzgerald is, and we're going to examine in a moment what this is about.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Hidden Agenda of the Libby Indictment. We are now discussing the biography, in other words, the real truth about Patrick Fitzgerald.
As Time magazine states, when Abdulrahman was sentenced to life, Fitzgerald still wasn't satisfied. He eventually became the nation's top terrorism prosecutor. After the 1998 bombings of the United States embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, Patrick Fitzgerald immersed himself in the case for 3 years, learning about Islam Time reports and picking up Arabic in the process. In the end, the jury sentenced all four defendants to life in prison. Fitzgerald had requested the death penalty. He's like a Bing Crosby movie. He needs to get out for more. He's a bit of a moralist and up by his bootstraps Catholic boy with a strong sense of right and wrong, says David Bao, Time magazine. Well, Maya, this frame-up of the people who were victimized as the perpetrators of the bombings of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania by Patrick Fitzgerald flies in the face of the disclosure in the San Francisco Chronicle that the organizer of the bombings of the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were a CIA and FBI operative who had been not only in the pay and under the instruction of those agencies, but had also been sent in to organize the bodyguards of Osama bin Laden.
Well, Ralph, that leads into what I wanted to bring forward right now. An article, Satellites and Stars, on the Internet by Michael Griffin, and it's on the website of themightyorgan.com, states this. 1 week after the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were bombed on 7 August 1998 with the loss of 260 lives, the U.S. reacted by launching missile attacks against three camps in Afghanistan, alleged to be training terrorists loyal to Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda, the base network of operatives. Meanwhile, the international dragnet was closing on the Saudi-born renegade hiding out in Kandahar, the Taliban capital. But what we want to go into that's disclosed in this article, which continues, is the role of Patrick Fitzgerald. Although the article itself doesn't name Fitzgerald, it refers to the prosecutor, who, as we have stated, was Patrick Fitzgerald. On 4 November 1998, the Manhattan Federal Court issued a sealed indictment chronicling 238 separate charges against the Saudi, meaning Osama bin Laden, from participating in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and funding Islamicist groups in New Jersey, to conspiring with Sudan, Iran, and Iraq to attack U.S. installations. The indictment contained little hard evidential detail on bin Laden's involvement in the East African bombings of August 1998, for which he denied responsibility. The key words here are that the 238 separate charges contained little hard evidential detail. The Manhattan indictment, much of which was based upon the confession of a former tire store manager, Wadi Hajj, who was a friend of the chief suspect in the Nairobi bombings. 4 days after the indictment was issued, the CIA counterterrorism reward program dangled a $5 million bounty for information leading to the arrest of bin Laden. And as we know, this was never paid out. Bin Laden has never been caught. We think bin Laden is not even alive anymore. But the key factor here is how Patrick Fitzgerald crafted his 238 separate charges on the basis of the testimony of a supposed confession of one person.
There wasn't a scintilla of evidence to associate an obscure figure in 1993, namely Osama bin Laden, with the bombing of the World Trade Center. There was even less evidence to associate Osama bin Laden with the bombings of the Kenya and Tanzania embassies. Indeed, Osama bin Laden had immediately declared publicly that he had no involvement with any of these events. But that aside, the invention of the putative responsibility of Osama bin Laden in the very category of terror, central to this, is Patrick Fitzgerald. Indeed, he brought in convictions of the blind Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, knowing that he had nothing to do with this event and that he was set up by the FBI. The FBI, at the time, the office in New York, was perfectly well known to Patrick Fitzgerald in all the particularity of what it was doing. And we find as well that the point man for the putting away of John Gotti and the Gambino family, which was deeply involved with authorities in the state of New York and the city of New York, was Patrick Fitzgerald. Patrick Fitzgerald is a point man for the ruling class and indeed, in particular, for the Central Intelligence Agency. And that leads us very much into what is really involved with this entire process.
I'd like to refer to another piece of information that was in the Vivica Novak Amanda Ripley article of Time Magazine, October 30th, Mr. Fitzgerald Goes to Washington. And this refers to the fabrication of evidence in the same way as in the World Trade Center case against Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, or in the 238-point indictment against Osama bin Laden for the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. A federal judge rebuked Fitzgerald in 2003 for pursuing sensational charges against Inam Arnaout, who was head of an Islamic charity. Fitzgerald, writes the Time reporters, accused Arnaout of financing terrorism and having ties to Al-Qaeda. The judge threw out a 101-page report that Fitzgerald had submitted in an effort to enter hearsay evidence against Arnaout. Ultimately, Fitzgerald dropped the terrorism charge and Arnaout pleaded guilty to racketeering. The case of Fitzgerald is throw everything at them and then you will get something. And this was the case with the Gambinos also, where there was a hung jury and Fitzgerald got them to plead guilty to lesser charges to avoid a second trial.
Well, what emerges, Maya, and particularly in the article in the Wall Street Journal, which is entitled "Prosecutor Uses an Effective Playbook," it says he's a lot like the legendary enforcer. Goes after terrorists, mobsters, and politicians. In a 17-year career as a prosecutor, assigned the task of indicting Gotti and the Gambino family, as we have mentioned. But indeed, the key figure in associating Osama bin Laden with the attacks on the World Trade Center in 1993 and the Tanzania and Kenya bombings, the key figure in determining that Lynn Stewart was to be imprisoned and silenced. She faces 30 years. He took the stand as the first witness against Miss Stewart, and she is to be sentenced in December and faces 30 years in prison.
And Ralph, it goes much further, because look at what Fitzgerald is responsible for doing to American jurisprudence. For the 1993 World Trade Center case, he went to Civil War Sedition Acts. In the case of Lynn Stewart, it is not just an attack on Lynn Stewart. It is attack on all attorneys in waging their defense, because, one, you have no privacy in talking to your client, and two, it puts the fear of prosecution to attorneys who seek to defend people with any notoriety or for whom the government is launching a vast assault. It also then, if you look at the prosecution now during the grand jury investigation, it was Patrick Fitzgerald who sought to break the long-standing notion that a reporter's sources are confidential, that a reporter cannot be brought into court to disclose information provided by confidential sources. This is a man who is breaking down the long-standing basis of civil liberties in this country.
Well, Maya, let's be very clear about this. The rule of law, the rule of law involves an act that makes it a crime to expose the murder activities of secret intelligence operatives of the state power, violating the sovereignty and rights and attacking the very survival and lives of those who are students and trade unionists and dissidents in other societies. It is a crime to discuss this or to expose this. The lawyer-client privilege of confidentiality breached and violated by Patrick Fitzgerald, not only spying on Lynn Stewart and her client in an isolation cell, but indicting her and being the first witness, and she's exposed to 30 years. Quote, while working to build a case against Osama bin Laden and his associates for the bombing of two U.S. embassies overseas, Mr. Fitzgerald became immersed in the details of the terrorist network. He indicted bin Laden in absentia. He became the expert when he landed in Chicago on September 11th, 2001. Can I repeat this? He became the expert when he landed in Chicago on September 11th, 2001, to start his new job as a U.S. attorney. He took on the CIA leak case in December 2003 at the request of his friend and former colleague, Mr. Comey, Deputy Attorney General. Indeed, the activity of Fitzgerald is linked to the Deputy Attorney General and, indeed, in particular, to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Ralph, I think it's time now to move on to two other people in the scenario here, and for another time we'll have to deal with I. Lewis Libby and the neocons. By the way, I'd like to mention that in October 2003, we did a two-part series.
Yes, it was an incredible series, Maya. Don't hesitate to say it. The Gentlemen Killers
of the... Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA. It's two parts. It's on our program archive at www.takingaim.info, Outing the Gentlemen Killers of the CIA, in which we further detail the not just Valerie Plame and the workings of Joseph Wilson, their careers, but also the importance of outing the gentlemen killers of the CIA. But now let's deal briefly with Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson IV.
Okay, indeed, this is the central issue here because, let us be clear, I mean, the criminality of the neocons and the Bush regime and all of the acts that we have so often documented ourselves, which are central to the plans of the ruling class of the past four decades, are hardly something for which we do not wish to see not merely indictments, but these people to be brought to a people's justice. But that's not what's at work here. The husband of Valerie Plame is the former U.S. ambassador to Gabon. Indeed, Joseph Wilson IV has a long history of work for the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was the ambassador to Gabon, where as ambassador to Gabon, he ran the CIA operations there, which were seeking to obtain control by the United States over the oil of Gabon. Gabon produces the light sweet crude oil, which had been under French jurisdiction. The assignment of Mr. Wilson in Gabon was to displace the French on behalf of the Central Intelligence Agency and the United States. But he goes much further back than that, because the point man of the George Bush Senior Administration in the relationship with Saddam Hussein was none other than Joseph Wilson. Joseph Wilson was the deputy to April Glasby. Here let's go to Vanity Fair's profile on Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame. In 1998, Wilson found himself in Baghdad as the number two to Ambassador April Glasby. At that point, as the article in Vanity Fair makes clear, Saddam Hussein was a U.S. ally, but he was being watched by a hawk. The night of August 1st, Wilson had dinner with Saddam's principal arms buyer in Paris. And indeed, as we sat down to dinner, just him, myself, my wife, and five bodyguards armed, Wilson was the man who was in charge of relations with Saddam Hussein. Joseph Wilson and April Glasby and James Baker and George Bush Sr. organized and set up Saddam Hussein for the first Gulf War. What we're looking at here is the entire process through which the Bush Senior Administration, with Joseph Wilson as the point man, prepared for the first Gulf War. At the time of the Iranian Revolution, when the Shah was overthrown, the Central Intelligence Agency, and at that time the National Security Advisor of the Carter Administration, Zbigniew Brzezinski, met in Kuwait with Saddam Hussein, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, the Emir of Kuwait, Asaba, and they prepared for an invasion of Iran by Iraq to amputate the oil-producing province of Iran. During that very war, which took a million lives, it was the Central Intelligence Agency that orchestrated the arming and the sending of biological and chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein, and the financing of Iraq by the Emirates, by the sheikhs and the feudal regimes of the Emirates. At the same time, the Mossad, with closet backing from the United States, were arming Iran and Khomeini. Kissinger stated it clearly, we will bleed them white. And simultaneous with that, the United States directed the Emir of Kuwait to move his arbitrary borders 900 square kilometers north until he sat on the largest oil field of Iraq, the Rumaila oil fields. And at that point, the Emir of Kuwait bought the Santa Fe Drilling Company in Alhambra, California, the two directors of which were Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor of George Bush Sr., and Robert Mosbacher, its Secretary of Commerce. They bought the slant drilling equipment for $2.3 billion. They sucked out $14 billion of Iraqi oil. At that point, Joseph Wilson, on behalf of George Bush Sr., along with April Glasby, says to Saddam Hussein, "You should rectify this. You have a grievance here."
Ralph, we should mention this is not information that's in the Vanity Fair profile of Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame. This is a profile written by Vicki Ward. It's available on various blogs on the Internet. And it was a January 17, 2004 article from Vanity Fair entitled Double Exposure, which tries to make Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame into the nation's heroes and heroines. The history that Ralph is detailing is in Iraq and Kuwait, a history suppressed by Ralph. And it's very important to look at the quote of Wilson with Tariq Aziz. In the Vanity Fair, they quote Wilson saying to Tariq Aziz, "You have your army in Kuwait City and we have our Navy ships in the Gulf," as if there was an impasse. But in effect, what you have is Wilson negotiating with Saddam Hussein, with Saddam Hussein saying, "Look, this is really about oil, and you give us part of Kuwait, and you accept that we have part of Kuwait, and we will provide you with cheap oil."
What Vanity Fair describes is the following. Joseph Wilson was discussing with both Tariq Aziz and Saddam Hussein the following. First of all, it was acknowledged that it was the Bush administration that had given the green light for Saddam Hussein to rectify his border, which had been taken by Kuwait under direction of the United States, and to reestablish the northern area of Kuwait that was, in fact, part of Iraqi territory. And the deal that was to be made, and Saddam Hussein offered, is, look, let me continue to reclaim my land that you've organized the taking of, and I will guarantee you cheap oil. And Joseph Wilson conned Saddam Hussein, even as they had suckered him into Kuwait, on behalf of Bush and on behalf of April Glasby and James Baker, by indicating to Saddam Hussein that a deal was in the works, even as the United States was preparing to remove Saddam Hussein and the Gulf War was unfolding. This, in fact, is the real nature of Wilson and Valerie Plame and their actual relationship to American imperialism.
What we have is a split in the U.S. ruling class between those who would marshal the incredible funds that it takes to destroy and occupy Iraq, that is destroying the U.S. economy and economies throughout the world, and also is leading to tremendous loss of life, that those who would do that and those who would conduct the war in a different way to gain their goals.
What we're talking about here, Maya, is the following. The Bush Senior Administration had in mind not to take responsibility for occupying Iraq, but to replace Saddam Hussein by blockading the country as the United Nations did under both Clinton and Bush Sr., and to arrange for Sunni officers to remove Saddam Hussein and to effect the same goals with a coup as opposed to a U.S. occupation. Those are the divisions that we're describing here. In 1997, Valerie Plame moved back to Washington because, as was recently reported in the New York Times, the CIA suspected that her name had been on a list given to the Russians by the double agent Aldridge Ames. At the same time, Wilson came back to Washington as the senior director for African Affairs at the National Security Council, where he was under the Reagan administration's Chester Crocker and was considered the most effective person in that job, was Wilson, not only for Reagan, but later for Clinton.
Ralph, we have to mention that when you say she came back to the United States, that Valerie Plame for 20 years had functioned as an undercover agent for the CIA. And the last year, she was working under a front company, Brewster Jennings and Associates. Now, Brewster Jennings and Associates, with a supposed address at 101 Arch Street in Boston, there really is no company there, but Brewster Jennings, the name has residence, particularly in the oil industry, because Brewster Jennings was the founder of Saucony Vacuum Oil Company, which was the predecessor to Mobil Oil, now ExxonMobil, and well known to the Saudis, particularly the Saudi-owned company Aramco. So she had an incredible cover just by the name of Brewster Jennings. Brewster Jennings now dead, and there really was no Brewster Jennings Associates company. And she ran agents in the Middle East, and particularly in Algeria. This means she recruited the killers, the contract killers. She supervised their assignments. And in 1990-91, it's the only time that she really was attached to any embassy, although there's no, her name doesn't appear in any of the embassy directories. Other than that, she was working deep undercover, supposedly in the energy field, really, as a person who was supervising and recruiting the killer squads throughout the Middle East.
Well, Maya, let me just take a moment here to see the conjuncture here of the role of both Wilson and Plame. Wilson's desk was both North Africa and Africa. Joseph Wilson was in Burundi, where he met his second wife. By the way, he worked for Al Gore, as did his wife Valerie Plame, even as they were supporting both Bush and Gore, which gives us an indication of what we're dealing with here. When he returned to Africa as deputy chief of mission in the Congo Republic, he was also instrumental in setting up the process that led to the withdrawal of Cuban troops from the Angolan Civil War and began the CIA backing of Savimbi. Brewster Jennings was the NOC, or non-official cover, of a covert operative who was in fact the principal instrument for dealing with the Saudis on behalf of U.S. intelligence. Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson are deeply involved with the Central Intelligence Agency. And the second part of this show, we're going to document how the planting of the information about the yellow cake was in fact an entrapment of the Bush administration by the Central Intelligence Agency that was fighting back for the recovery of control over policy that the Bush senior administration had secured and that the neocons under the sun were seeking to undermine. What we're dealing with here is an internecine battle between sectors of the ruling class. Patrick Fitzgerald, Joseph Wilson, and Valerie Plame are central to the war on terror, central to the first Gulf War, central to the murder squads that operated throughout Africa and indeed through North Africa and the Middle East. This is not a dispute about those who seek to bring to justice the crimes of the Bush administration. These are the criminals and the thieves falling out amongst themselves. Justice has nothing to do with it. Our rights have precious little to do with any of this. The right of free speech, the right to expose the crimes of our rulers, is really what is under attack here, even if they target their opponents within the ruling class under that rubric. The right to the confidentiality of a lawyer-client relationship, the right of an attorney to defend those who are targeted with false accusations by the ruling class, that is what is under attack here. This is a criminal ruling class. We have no stake in the disputes between them except to expose all of them for what they are, and to show the real agenda of a decaying capitalist order that is engaging in bloodletting, even as it takes as its target those who are in control and who are disputing over the spoils.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Hidden Agenda of the Libby Indictment, will appear on our website, www.takingaim.info, and also on the WBAI archive. You can contact us at takingaim@patbell.net. You know, I'm standing here to be.
in the eyes. That's